Welcome back to Eschatology Matters on the Fight Laugh Feast Network. I'm your host, Josh Howard. Are you a Christian struggling to find companies that align with your values and beliefs? Well, Squirrely Joe's has you covered for all of your coffee needs. All of their coffee is hand-selected and roasted fresh every day by a family of fellow believers. Try them out and you'll savor exceptional coffee while knowing that your investment supports a company committed to following God's teachings and upholding truth and righteousness, ensuring your hard-earned money contributes to the growth of God's kingdom. Stop giving your hard-earned dollars to pagans who support evil. We also have a fantastic offer for our listeners. Your first bag of coffee is free. All you have to do is cover the shipping. Head over to squirrelyjoes.com/ematters to claim your free bag of coffee. So this is our fourth installment in our Building Christian Communities series. We've had, if you have not been keeping up with the series, we've had Michael Foster came on first for us, Joe Rigney came on, and then we had Dr. Joe Boot on last. But today I'm joined by Pastor Doug Wilson of Christ Church in Moscow, Idaho. So Pastor Doug, thank you so much for joining us and chatting a bit today.
Happy to do it.
Yes, sir. This is actually, I was noticing in my notes, this is your fourth appearance on Eschatology Matters. Second time talking to me, but fourth overall. Which
really? Okay.
Yeah. I don't know if that...
Look at me go.
Yeah. You've made it now. So if you were wondering, this is how you know you've arrived. No, yeah. Fifth time you get a sub sandwich. No, but you've had a very busy week. I mentioned that before we started recording, so I appreciate your time just coming on. But I felt like this had a little bit to do with us talking about Christian communities. You guys just released a chat with I can't remember the guy's name, but on the Room for Nuance.
Sean.
Yes, sir.
Sean DeMars. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you guys had that interview. That was solid. I recommend that to everybody. It invigorated me to go buy protein powder, among other things, but it was a great way to just engage. That was super helpful. But you were on, obviously, I think most people would have seen Tucker Carlson this week. And I'm not sure if you have any thoughts on that, Pastor Doug, but like when I'm hearing that on Tucker and we watched the full interview, just that seems to have a lot to do with what Christian culture and Christian community building is starting to look like. Did you have any thoughts on that? Is it related to that Tucker interview, perchance?
Yes. I think I may have mentioned in the interview, but I've said in other places that you can't fight a culture war unless you have a culture. You can't have a naval war without ships. You can't have tank warfare without tanks. And one of the problems that Christians have had, evangelicals have had, is they've attempted to fight a culture war without a distinctive culture.
Yeah.
And a culture requires the theme of your podcast here, community. Mm-hmm. Basically, if you try to do it without culture or community, you're fighting an ideological battle. It's simply fought out in seminar rooms or in books or in articles, but there's no instantiation of what you're talking about in the lives of actual people.
Right.
So in order to have a genuine cultural clash, Christians need to develop a distinctively Christian approach to culture. And that means life together.
Hmm. Yeah. And that's one of the things that I think, and this is one of the reasons why we wanted to certainly have you on for this, is anybody, whether they're a fan or a critic of Moscow, can really identify a culture there, right? Like there's a distinctive cultural element. For many years, many of us as Christians, we've heard the whole, you've got that whole petard of like, we want to be known for what we're for, but not what we're against, that sort of thing. But I think there's a little bit of truth to that when it comes to culture, that we can critique the culture around us. We can see things on fire, but we're not oftentimes very equipped for building our own sort of distinctly Christian culture.
Right. Right.
So you guys have been about this for a while. You've written many books on this. Rules for Reformers was one that kind of popped into my head, but I think most recently probably Gashmus Saith It.
Yes. Gashmus Saith It. The first one on this general theme was Angels in the Architecture.
There it is.
A number of years ago. Rules for Reformers was more how to get there. Then there was a documentary, How to Save the World, which was sort of roughly occupying the same space that Gashmus Saith It was occupying. only in documentary form. So we've been talking about this for some time. And culture, the late Andrew Breitbart once said that culture is upstream from politics, which explains a lot about how our society is in free fall. And you don't have a political solution if the culture is gone. If the culture is the thing that's gone off the cliff,
right,
you're not going to be able to stop it politically. But Henry Van Til once said that culture is religion externalized. So just as politics is downstream from culture, culture is downstream from religion, faith, cultus. So the cultus is where you worship God, and that's the centerpiece of all cultural formation. And one of the problems is that evangelicals have bought into the secular ideal, which is the notion that you can have an atom form around no nucleus, which is just not going to happen. You're not going to have a solar system without a sun. You're not going to have an atom without a nucleus. You're not going to have a cohesive people group, a nation or a tribe or a culture of any sense, unless there's some set of shared ultimate commitments.
Mm-hmm.
That's got to be there. And Christians have to embrace that as just simply a reality, like water flows downhill. Basically, if you have a tight-knit group of Christians worshiping together, the first thing that's going to happen is a subculture is going to start to develop. And then if it's successful, like there's a Reformation revival and a lot of people doing it, then it's going to be a culture proper that's going to form. You can't stop it from happening,
right?
If you have 100,000 people, if you rounded up 100,000 Lutherans and dropped them off in South Dakota, a distinctive culture is going to take shape there. You can't stop it.
So culture is just sort of an inevitability of human gathering. One of the things that was fun walking through this, you know, just kind of from different perspectives. So like Joe Rigney came on, he's kind of talking about, you know, intersections of kind of like your life circles, like, you know, where you are in life and how those intersect with other people. Joe Boot comes on and he's sort of giving this kind of sweeping overview of Western civilization. So there's ways you can think of like a small culture, kind of like you're talking about, and it builds toward that bigger culture. But like in general, like what are you aiming at when you're talking about a distinctly Christian culture? What sort of maybe mile markers, what sort of guardrails, what sort of distinctive things must there be if you drop off the 100,000 Lutherans in South Dakota or whatnot? Like what sort of things are they looking to establish to sort of start to form and nurture that Christian culture?
Okay, so the first thing, there is a bare minimum that most people would recognize. In a Christian culture, the businessman wouldn't cheat, for example. You would have equal weights and measures. You're not going to have the butcher with his thumb on the scale. So most people, most evangelicals think, okay, Jesus saved me and forgave my sins, so I should straighten up and fly right. I should pay my taxes and be an honest businessman. So basically, we are a typical American that's maybe 10% cleaner. And that is true. We should be honest, and that's the big E on the eye chart that everybody sees. But I think that there are numerous ramifications to faith in Christ that go into culture formation that people don't generally identify. Okay, they say just get a job, play nice, you know, do what you're expected to do. I think a strong element of Christian cultural formation ought to be do what you're not expected to do. So one of the things that is, I learned this from George Gilder, one of the things that is essential to information is surprise. Right? If you're not surprised, you haven't learned anything.
Hmm.
Right? And one of the things that we've been very gratified to see taking shape here in Moscow has been a spirit of entrepreneurial enterprise. People starting businesses, coming up with bright ideas, plugging them in, hiring people, doing new things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like in a Christian culture, you'll have, it's not like the Christians come to town and you had three grocery stores and one of them is run by the evangelical and it's 10% cleaner, right? Okay. That's good. Okay. That's great. And I don't have any complaint about that. But what I would like to see and what we are seeing is innovative thinking, sort of a conquer the world spirit of enterprise, right? Yeah. And boldness, in other words. So it's not just boldness in preaching the gospel, although that is to be right at the center of it. So the way the worship is at the center is going to influence and inspire how everybody does everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
So the preaching on Sunday morning is going to inform and inspire child rearing. It's going to inform and inspire the formation of Christian schools. It's going to inform and inspire the person who starts a software company, or the person who opens a restaurant, or the person who starts ministering to special needs kids. All of those things, they're going to say, oh, this is something I can take and plug this in. Mm-hmm. And surprise everybody, right? So that has been one of the blessings of seeing this Christian culture take shape in Moscow, and that has been the surprise. So-and-so is doing thus and such. Really?
So this makes a lot of sense, though, why it walks hand in hand with the sort of, like, not only the educational endeavors you guys have been participating in, but also the, you know, I'm thinking like New St. Andrews and stuff like that. So you're looking to sort of a kind of broadly classical Christian education. And then also most of the stuff that I hear, you know, Ben Merkel talking about and NSA putting out is encouraging, kind of like you said, like an entrepreneurial, I'm going to go do something new and an innovative kind of spirit. I think that's very unfamiliar to a lot of Christians, that we don't really put that side by side with what we would consider Christian culture. Christian culture would be more like, this is me doing good Christian-y things, you know, like going to church, singing hymns, or whatever we relegate that as. But we would kind of think of those innovative entrepreneurial endeavors as something separate from Christian culture. But you're saying they walk hand in hand.
Correct. And I would say that one of the first words that comes to mind when someone says, okay, Christian culture taking shape, what comes to mind? The word that should come to mind is risk.
Mm.
Okay. And when the risk is taken and God blesses it, the result is surprise. People say, oh, that's possible, is it?
Mm.
Right. That can be done, is it? But it's not going to happen if everybody is timid, faint-hearted, wants to stick close to the shore for Jesus.
Right.
Right. So when the spirit of timidity, Bible says that we're not given a spirit of timidity. Well, how does that translate into our daily lives, into our vocation, into our encounters with non-believers, into our child rearing? How does it translate to not be given over to a spirit of timidity?
Right. Okay, so you're kind of answering, I was trying to lead into this, but you're already starting to answer it. But some of maybe your reflections on why intentionally building Christian communities is so important. Obviously, you've shared about this, you know, many places that I've read and heard about, so, sort of, you know, coming from your father and then there in Moscow. But just maybe for those who are a little bit unfamiliar with the story, or even just kind of general guiding principles, why is it really important for Christians, especially in 2024, when so many things and so many, you know, corners seem to be on fire? Why is building Christian communities and looking for those things you just described so important? Why put out the risk? Why put out the effort toward these things? What's the drive?
This first thing I'm going to say might sound like it's contradictory to the thing I just said about risk, but it's not. It all harmonizes. And that is, it's a simple matter of self-defense.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. I'm currently reading Aaron Wren's book, Life in Negative World.
Right. Yep.
So I'm a boomer. I remember positive world, and I remember neutral world, and I can clearly see negative world.
Right.
One of the points that Wren makes is that many evangelicals, I don't think that it's true of all of them, but many evangelicals have not budgeted for the shift that has happened. And so consequently, they're still acting as though they're in positive world or they're in neutral world. And why don't we get to do that? You guys just did that. Why don't we get to do that? You're not playing fair. And we think we have a legitimate complaint that they ought to listen to, but they're not going to listen to it because this is the complaint department in negative world. You don't get to make a complaint. You're not qualified, right? I believe that the left is profoundly hostile to Christianity, would outlaw us the moment they could, they will, and are going to harass us until that point. In other words, the infection has landed, and we need to develop antibodies. And the steady as she goes, take your self-defense for granted, life in positive world is not going to cut it. So if you're a pastor, if you're a Christian leader, then you have to be thinking over the next 10 years, you have to be thinking in terms of the survival of your people. Are they going to make it? The survival of your church, the survival of your Christian community. So that's the first thing. Now, the reason this is consistent with what I said earlier about risk is Chesterton says somewhere that sometimes the best way to preserve life is through a willingness to die. Right? So if you just go play dead like a possum, or we just freeze up, or let's hope this passes over. That is the deer in the headlights problem, and it's not going to work.
Right.
Christians need to actively think through what's coming after us, what's coming down the pike toward us, and what are we going to do? Now, in positive world and in neutral world, the pervasive individualism of American life infected the church badly, right? We have a lot of people floating around as members of the invisible church,
right.
Solitary atoms, not ADAM, but ATOM. A lot of Christians live atomistic lives.
Right.
They're just a solitary monad, a solitary unit. And if you dump a bunch of these monads into a sack, it's like a sack full of BBs, you know, hard individual units. And it's pushing on the side of this sack is like a beanbag chair. You can manipulate it. It's malleable. And then to make it even the statists, the totalitarians like it that way, because solitary BBs are easy to manipulate. Okay. And so that's why they want pot legalized. That's why they want porn easily available, because that what that does is greases the BBs.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Bonds don't form. Now, in a true Christian community, in a robust Christian community, what you have is complex molecules start to form. Each individual is bonded to other individuals in a complex series of relationships, right?
Right.
So Nancy and I have three kids. We have 18 grandkids. We have two great-grandkids. We have our grandkids' spouses and our kids' spouses. So we're a small tribe, okay, and a complex molecule. And the in my family, this extended family, the loyalty levels are up there with the Sicilian mafia. Okay. So, and then this little tribal unit of ours is in a larger community, the Kirker community, which is the next level up of a complex molecule.
Right.
With bonds and loyalties and connections and intermarriages and, you know, all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And what we've got and what we've seen taking shape here in Moscow, it would be an example of Edmund Burke's little platoons. These little platoons are resistant and are profoundly and effectively resistant to the encroachments of the state.
Okay. Yep.
Okay. So, and this is why the state hates them. This is why the state is at war with the Christian and biblical definition of marriage. For example, what they're doing is they're greasing the BBs. Mm-hmm. And so consequently, if we fight for a robust understanding of covenant marriage, covenant families, covenant communities in churches, covenant relationships between churches, what we're doing is building something that is not susceptible to the central strategy that the progressive left is employing, which is to fragment us into atomistic individuals alone, and right. And then deal with this, pick us off one at a time.
Right. And I, just to push back on what you said, just one little thing, I wouldn't discount that the state isn't favorable toward you guys, because according to Twitter, Langley's following you now. So maybe it's catching on a bit. But no, what you just presented, though, with the atomistic thing, that's so, because it's a different way of looking at church culture. You know, we remark frequently on the fact that, you know, and maybe it was just I wasn't listening for it, but covenant was just not something that I grew up thinking about. Like, covenant was very foreign, even now for our people and most churches, introducing them to thinking in covenantal terms with one another seems very foreign. But what is very just natural about the way we look at church life is, you know, you stay at a church for 2 or 3 years, you know, people just kind of bounce around. Usually families move off, you know, they're all separate from one another. Everything about our lives are disparate and separate from one another. Whereas what you're suggesting is, like, you know, the family gathering together around the Sabbath meal, like that is very foreign for a lot of Christians to think about. But what you're suggesting is, like, that's the ties that are going to make it through the next storm or through the current storm.
That is correct.
Yeah.
There are liturgical bonds, and the liturgies are not just things you do Sunday morning.
Right.
It would be things like each family, each nuclear family, having the liturgy of sitting down to eat together every night at 6, mm-hmm. which is what I grew up doing, what my wife and I did with our kids when they were growing up, which they do with their kids. And then the extended clan gets together once a week and sits down together. That's a liturgy. I'm fond of saying that too many Christians have thought that worldview, to have a Christian worldview, is simply the thoughts that you think in your head. And that's one component of it. But I like to describe it as a worldview wheel.
Mm-hmm.
So the worldview wheel has got 4 spokes, not just one. If you just have one spoke, basically what you have is a pogo stick. It's, you know, you don't have. And what we need to progress from the pogo stick to the wheel. The axle would be Christ. Okay, always the center would be Christ. But in the wheel, 2 of the spokes would be propositional, and 2 of the spokes would be enacted, lived out. So the propositional spokes would be, the first one would be the worldview thing that we're all accustomed to, the doctrinal one, the Apostles' Creed, the Westminster Confession of Faith, your faith commitments. When someone says, what do you believe about God? What do you believe about man? What do you believe about sin and salvation? You answer the question. Basically, the worldview spoke would be the catechism answers.
Okay. Yep. Yep.
What is the chief end of man? And a secular atheist would has a different worldview, he would answer all those questions differently. We would say, in the beginning, God. And he would say, in the beginning, the primordial ooze suffered a lightning strike, right? So that's how you answer the big questions would be the worldview. The other propositional spoke would be the narrative or the story of your people. How did we get here? So there's a map of history that has an X on it and that says you are here. Okay. Well, most evangelical Christians have no idea. Right. You know, their church was founded by a charismatic preacher in 1987, and that's as far back as they go. Right. Right. So the second propositional spoke would go all the way back to the book of Genesis, God's history of his people through Israel, the calling of Abraham, and then the 29th chapter of Acts, the post-apostolic history. Basically, it's all narrative. Right. Okay. So, and that's what the evolutionists do when they tell their story of evolution.
Yep.
Right. There's a doctrinal component to evolution, but there's also the narratival thing, the caveman doing his thing. National Geographic never hesitates to tell the story.
Right.
Okay. So those are the two propositional spokes. The two enacted spokes would be lifestyle and ritual. Okay. Lifestyle would be wedding customs, how you get your kids to school, the music you listen to, the movies you watch. You know, that is a part of the shared community experience. It's lifestyle, marriage customs, family customs. A good example of that would be, well, sometimes lifestyle and ritual overlap. So a good example of that would be all over America on Thanksgiving Day, everybody gets together and eats a turkey.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why is that mandatory? well, it is.
Right.
And people feel an enormous obligation to, you know, to get together with kin and eat mashed potatoes and gravy and turkey.
Right.
Right. And that's that would be an example of ritual and lifestyle. Okay. But lifestyle is mostly ordinary day-to-day things. And then the rituals would be civic secular rituals, 4th of July parades, standing for the national anthem, seventh inning stretch at a baseball game, and the way you pray and lead devotions at your family dinner table. Those are all liturgies. Now, if these four things taken together are thick, that they could be thin or thick. You could have an evangelical family that says grace over every meal, but Lord, please bless the food. Amen. That would be thin. Mm. Okay.
Yep.
Thick would be where you thank the Lord for the food. You debrief from the day. Everybody talks about, and I had a chance to share the Lord with so-and-so. And then after the meal, dad gets the Bible down and reads a chapter. The little kids say their catechism answer. Then mom brings out dessert. That would be thick ritual.
Right.
Okay. It's got texture to it. And the thicker it is, the stickier it is. So here, this is something we do in our worship service. We recite the Apostles' Creed every week in our worship. Christian, what do you believe? Hmm. And the whole congregation standing recites the Apostles' Creed, which means that all our two-year-olds have it memorized.
Wow. Yep.
Okay. Now, twice a year, we say the definition of Chalcedon and Nicaea. Chalcedon in the run-up to Christmas and Nicaea Easter. And so we touch base, but most of the time it's the Apostles' Creed. All the kids who have the Apostles' Creed memorized have it memorized all the time, not just at church. right? Mm-hmm. If someone turned to them on the subway one day and said, "Christian, what do you believe?"
Right.
They could put it in their own words. They could say what they believe. But it's all there, mm-hmm. right? And one time, D.L. Moody was in Scotland, and he was talking to a bunch of kids. He was a mainstream evangelical type, and he was just talking in an off the cuff way. And he said to the kids, "What is faith?" And one of the boys popped up and gave the Westminster Shorter Catechism answer. Answer is the and Moody said, "Son, you are enormously blessed to have grown up in Scotland, right? Because you've got all these treasures. You've got this pantry full of good stuff right. that you can bring out as the occasion demands." Well, that kind of thick worldview inculcation is the stuff that is going to be hard to eradicate with one COVID scare.
Right.
Okay. A few years ago, I only do it with some of the kids now, but I used to because our church has grown too big. But I would do an interview with all the high school seniors who are graduating and going off to college in different places, or going to St. Andrews here locally, or to the U of I. I would interview all the kids, and now that's a shared responsibility among a number of ministers, not just me, because there are too many of them. But I noticed something that was really heartening to me. And these are kids who, one of my questions is, "So talk to me about your spiritual life in terms of prayer and Bible reading. Are you, tell me how that's going." And over 90% of the kids I talked to, graduating high school seniors, were daily Bible readers on their own, had a prayer life. They had a Christian walk that mm-hmm. they were actually walking, that was not propped up by whatever dad was doing at the table, right, at the dinner table. And this means that when I'm preaching, I can preach to the teenagers, assuming a baseline of biblical literacy. They've read the Bible a couple of times. They right. know that Abraham lived before David did, that, they don't read the New Testament and wonder why Jesus had to die four times,
Right. No, that's excellent. So like when you're thinking then toward building Christian communities, like because I'm thinking like practical steps. I know a lot of, and COVID was a tremendous blessing, I think, in this. It was a shake up in many ways. I mean, I think every Christian could kind of relate to that it was a troublesome time and yet a blessing from God at the same time. But for a lot of, I know, especially Christian families, they're looking toward, how can I encourage this in my church? How can I encourage this in my community? I'm going to go cast my vote at the poll and not even really sure where that's going to go, in a variety of ways. But what can I do to build it here? You're just sort of, essentially, you haven't, like pressed in on the practicalities, but one practicality would be the dinner table of your home. Yep. Would be one immediate way to build Christian culture.
It's something you could start tonight.
Right. Right.
Right. It doesn't take everybody's eating anyway. Just stop eating your dinners over the sink.
Oh, that's perfect. What other ways for, like, especially for like Christian families? So, you're thinking, like you said, take the plate away from the sink, go sit down with your family. So that's gold. What are some other maybe practical ways that you can look toward building that in your community? Let's say you start to get it figured out with your family. You're looking at it, your broader church culture, and maybe it's a little bit anemic. Maybe it's a little bit like that BB bag that you were talking about earlier. How do you start to build that maybe where you are and where God's placed you?
One of the things I would recommend, particularly if you're a pastor or you've got an elder board that's trying to answer that question, you can do more.
Okay.
Right. But let's say you're just Joe parishioner in an average evangelical church. What can I do? I can get my own family in order. I can start to thicken up the worldview experience in my family.
Right.
And one other element that I would add there and springboard it out into the community is not only eat together, not only dinner time, but you can incorporate overlap this with dinner time is read together.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. Not only dad read a passage of scripture, but read the kids, read Narnia aloud, read Winnie the Pooh aloud, read The Lord of the Rings aloud. Just so dad gathers the kids and reads to them.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are treasures there that, and you're getting a twofer. What you're doing is you're getting the treasure of the experience of whatever the book is imparting, but you're also spending time with dad. Dad is leading. Dad is assuming responsibility. And then I would segue that principle into your community. You don't have to, I wouldn't start by critiquing your pastor. I wouldn't recommend that you start, don't go nag him about why don't you preach on this? Why don't you preach on that? I would recommend to Joe and Jane parishioner, that they ask the elders for permission to start a book group.
Ooh, nice. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And then they talk to different people in the church who they know are like-minded or semi-like-minded or are willing to become like-minded. And there are a host of red meat books that would either strengthen or radicalize decent Christian people who haven't really thought about some issues.
Right.
Right. And if you just have a book group that meets at your home once a month, and here's the book, you know, you assign the book. This time around, let's read Carl Truman's book on Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, or his Strange New World, which is a more accessible version of the same thing. Those are meaty books that are really going to start messing with people's assumptions and just provide a channel for that to flow in.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay. So I would say provide an encouragement and incentive to read. Okay. And that would be done by means of a social event, a book club.
Okay. So that's you on the lay level, which I think should be encouraging for people, because I think a lot of people are seeing it, they're sensing it, they're just kind of trying to dig in. What if you are that pastor or deacon? So it's not just Joe coming to the pastor and saying, you know, I sure wish you'd switch your sermon series. But if you are in one of the leadership or teaching roles within the church, what could be a way that you could start encouraging your church toward that? You know, you look at your church culture, it looks a bit like a bag of BBs, disparate fellowship in some sense. And you're trying to kind of make a little bit more of that structure. What might you start with?
Right. What I would do is I'd start with your elder board and basically outline a plan that I'd like to preach through either this book of the Bible because of all the things it addresses, or I'd like the elder's blessing on a series of topical sermons.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of each sermon outline for further reading, see. And then game it out with your elders beforehand.
Okay.
Because if the church is loosey-goosey, okay, then doing what you need to do is going to lose some people. You're going to lose some people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? And if the elder board just thinks in terms of tithers, you know, tithers in seats,
right.
You've got a challenge. Right? But yeah. If they understand that one of the jobs of faithful ministry is not only to attract the right kind of people to the church, but also to get rid of the right kind of people, get rid of the people who are going to be a drag or a weight, slowing the church down. And it's far better to have them just come to the conclusion, you know, this is not the most conducive atmosphere for the way that I like to think.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be done from the pulpit. So the pastor should go to the elders and say, I would like to grow this sort of plant in our greenhouse. And I would like to be a thermostat that sets the temperature for that kind of plant.
Right.
Okay. Can I have your blessing on doing this?
Right.
And then if they give the blessing, then I would do it. If you have to win the elders over, then I would start a book group with the elder board.
I like it. Okay, good. So you're already starting to answer, and I hope you've got time for one last one, because I wanted to make sure to close with just kind of some obstacles, because again, you guys have been at this for a while. I'm sure you've made missteps or seen others make missteps over the years. I'm even listening to some of your, especially right there at the end, talking about like kind of potential friction with elder board or with church congregants. But what are some of the like major obstacles you can see? So you see this vision, you see the world around us, you understand that, and again, every generation thinks that they're in a unique moment, and that's probably true, but we seem to be in a uniquely unique moment. So you see like a particular time for some real tangible Christian community. What are pitfalls that you need to be aware of? What are some things I could rush headlong into without looking?
Okay, I would say the biggest single temptation / pitfall for someone who's, let's say, a pastor is red-pilled. Okay, oh no, look what happened when I was sleeping.
Right. Okay. Yep.
He finally starts to see everything. He starts to read a bunch of things, and he gets up to speed. He's a good reader. His biggest temptation is going to be impatience.
Yeah.
Okay. Going too fast.
Right.
Christopher Dawson once said the Christian church lives in the light of eternity and can afford to be patient.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's the revolutionaries who are impatient. Reformers are patient. Okay. Yep. So he should say, okay, we've got a lot of work to do. We need to approach this with a steady as she goes mentality.
Yeah.
So there was an episode where when we introduced liturgical changes or something coming up, we did a good deal of preparation beforehand. We didn't just spring it on people.
Mm-hmm.
But I made the mistake of one time we introduced the liturgical change of in the doxology at the end of the sermon, at the end of the service, we introduced the liturgical practice of the whole congregation lifting up their hands in the doxology
mm-hmm.
at the end. And that was one of the changes. Most of the time we did a lot of prep work for the change. Going from grape juice to wine in communion, those sorts of things. We introduced it very slowly. But this one, I think everybody had 1 week notice. And raising your hands was a bigger deal for some people than we.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not charismatic. I don't want to raise my hands.
Yep.
So I would say just go slow and steady. You're pulling a 10-pound fish in on a 5-pound line.
Hmm.
So don't yank.
Yeah, no, that's good. So slow and steady, be patient with the Reformation. Any other major pitfalls that you've seen, maybe particularly like younger ministers? Because it seems to be a lot of the younger guys are catching this vision. I know that that gets accused of LARPing and stuff like that. But there's a lot of honest young pastors, especially right now, that are trying to dig in and form Christian communities. Any other like major pitfalls that might pop into your head on that one?
Yeah, the glory of young men is their strength. And the glory of older, wiser heads is the wisdom,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I would say if you're young and energetic and all of the things have come together, Paul says, don't lay hands on a neophyte, on a young Tyndale. The Greek word is neophyte. Tyndale translated as young scholar. Don't lay hands on a young scholar. Because he will fall into the temptation of the devil, which was pride, right?
Yeah.
So basically, if you're a young buck, I would say don't start snarking at the boomers on your elder board.
Right.
And I say this in a self-interested way, being a boomer myself, but basically having the young guys tell the old guys, good job, you did a great job back in your day, we'll take it from here.
Right.
is not what young men need to be saying.
Right.
Right. Now, at this, but I would go around and I would kick the boomers in the ankle also and say, you need to let the young men whose glory is their strength exercise it.
Yeah. Amen.
Right. You need to not, don't be threatened at their desire to go do something.
Right.
They should go do it with your wisdom, but your wisdom should not be turning into timidity.
Right. No, that's so good. So this is encouraging and it's practical. I appreciate your thoughts on it. Pastor Doug, where can people follow you? Just in case they have no idea where to follow you, but you're doing lots of stuff in lots of places these days. Where can they catch up with you?
Yeah, the one, basically, if you go to my blog, which is Blog and May Blog, the address is dougwills.com. On the front page, on the landing page, there's a portal to pretty much everything I'm involved with.
Perfect.
So if you just go to dougwills.com, and scroll down, you'll see a row of things, New St. Andrews, Canon Press, ACCS, Logos School. So pretty much everything I've got, every pie I've got my finger in is there.
Perfect. Now, I know you're a busy guy, so thanks so much for carving out the time. Greatly appreciated and encouraging, sir.
Very good. Thank you.
Seated here at my right hand.